Welcome to the Lesbian Book Club with Claire Lydon. Please enjoy the podcast from My Lesbian Radio.
Hello and welcome to episode 45 of the Lesbian Book Club with me, your host, Claire Lydon. This month, we've got a terrific interview for you with US author Lise McTeague, and you're going to hear the interview I did with her very, very shortly. But first, let's check out what's hot in the UK and US Amazon fiction charts, as well as telling you what's been going on in the world of lesfic and, of course, in the world of me. So first up, the Amazon lesbian fiction charts, and this month doing well in both the US and the UK is Eliza Lenski with her new book Sunscreen and Coconuts. Eliza was one of the first guests I had on the Lesbian Book Club podcast, and she was positively lovely. Check that out. I think it's like episode 7 or something, so it's quite far back. When I didn't have as much grey hair. Not that the podcast has caused me to have grey hair. It's been nothing but pleasure, I tell you. Anyway, Eliza's new book, Sunscreen and Coconuts. This one's got pink skies and palm trees on the cover. And the story concerns a holiday romance between a woman called Mercy and a woman called Kate. Now, the blurb doesn't say much more than that. It's very succinct to the point, but that hasn't stopped it selling like the proverbial hotcakes. And the reviews are saying it's fun, sweet, sexy, and jam-packed with comedy and a pet chicken. Yes, you don't get many of them to the pound in a lesbian fiction, so hurrah for a book with a pet chicken, I say. I've read Eliza's Don't Call Me Hero, which I think is one of her most known books, and I'd say it's one of my all-time favourite lesbian fiction novels, and I've read quite a few, so this is probably worth a look. It's a lighter, more sort of summary read. Also doing well on both sides of the Atlantic is Radcliffe's latest book, Passionate Rivals. Now, we know Radcliffe can write. That's a given. She's written a gazillion books. And this one's a medical drama with moody medics giving you the eye from the cover. Excellent character names, as we've come to expect with Radcliffe. The two protagonists are called Emirate and Sydney, so top marks for that. And this one is about two high-flying surgeons going for the same job. The only snag to that is that they had a brief thing 5 years earlier, and then they haven't seen each other since. And now they meet again and they're going for the same job. What are the chances? It's got all the ingredients of a chart topper. It's got second chance romance, surgeons, power struggles, and no doubt heat. Pick it up if it sounds like that might tickle your fancy. Our old friend J.A. Armstrong is also riding high in the charts. I think she's got two in the top 10, actually. One as J.A. Armstrong and one as her alter ego, Nancy Ann Healy. Or maybe that's the other way around. Can't remember what her actual name is. Maybe it's none of the above. I'm not sure. Anyway, J.A. Armstrong's latest is called Exposing Eden, Book 2 in the Journey of Exploration series. Now, this one is an erotic romance between Diana and Eden, an art gallery owner and a paediatrician. Something about Saturday night soirees is in the blurb, which makes me think of Abigail's Party and Demis Roussos and cheese and pineapple on sticks and possibly keys in a bowl. Anyway, it sounds very far removed from Saturday nights around my house, which generally involves strictly match the day and then falling asleep after a little bit too much red wine on the sofa. But that wouldn't make such a good book, would it? So good job. J.A. Armstrong knows the ingredients for a great tale. So if that one sounds like something you might like, it's available for being bought or being borrowed on Kindle Unlimited. Also doing well, UK and stateside, is Claire Hyten Stevenson, who I met recently at Elcon in Bristol. More of that later. Her latest novel is Escape and Freedom and focuses on two women who've got a lot of grief and abuse in their past, but how they come together in the present and help each other find their own kind of freedom. Lucy and Nicole are the women in question, and if you're like your lesfic with a sizable slice of angst, then this one is for you. Lastly, Jerry Hill's Neighbours Without You, obviously, is storming up the charts with its Jerry Hillness. And there's not much more to say about that, really, is there? It's Jerry Hill. It's going to be great. So pick it up if you haven't read it. And Cara Malone's Cinders wins this week's Sexy Cover Award with a hot firefighter cradling a mug of tea on the cover. And who doesn't love a hot firefighter with doughy eyes? This one is about firefighter Cynthia, Sin to her mates, who has a wicked stepmother and a crush on a wealthy local socialite, Marigold. If that sounds familiar, it's because this book is a take on Cinderella, and it's blazing up the charts. See what I did there? Blazing firefighter. That's why they pay me the big bucks for this job, you know. Yes, yes indeed. So that's the chart roundup for September 2018, my birthday month. So happy birthday to me, and happy birthday to you, all my fellow Virgoans, and also to all the people who are, I think it's Libra, isn't it, end of September? Librans. I'm going with Librans. If it's wrong, you know, write in, complain, but I think it's Librans. I've got a lot of friends, actually. I've got four people whose birthday is on September 26th, so that makes them Librans. But obviously Virgo is the best star sign. So, yes, happy birthday to you if September is your birthday month. What have I been up to since we last spoke? Well, dear listener, I've been busy writing book five in the London romance series, London Actually. I kind of finished it. I got it off to first draft before I went on holiday to Croatia. Then I came back and wrote the second draft over 2 weeks, and then I sent it to my editor, and it came back on September the 10th. So I'm just sort of sitting down now and revising it. And you can expect an October release for this one. Luckily, it's come back from the editor with some changes, but they're not vast, so that's good. Now it's all systems go as I try to harness and giddy up my finishing energy to get the book to market. If you've read or listened to the rest of the London romance series, this one focuses on Becca, who is Rachel's sister. Rachel was the star of book four, The London of Us. And Becca goes to her cousin's wedding and meets the intriguing Cleo. Cleo has been single for 2 years after a marriage breakdown and is determined not to make the same mistakes again, which means no younger women, because her wife was younger. Enter Becca, who's 16 years younger. Oh dear. as I say, expect an October release for this one, and I'm pretty excited to get this one out to you guys. And this was going to be the last book in the London romance series, but I had such a brilliant response to The London of Us, which made me very excited to write this one. And now another character's popped up who could have her own book next time around. And so I think there might be another London romance book. You heard it here first. I've literally just decided as I'm sitting here. I've been toying with it, but I spoke to one of my early readers yesterday, and they were like, oh, I see how you're setting this up for the next book. And I was like, I wasn't actually planning on it. But I think it would be, I think as long as, no, I think I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I've talked myself into it. So expect a book six in the London romance series. I've got to think of another title with London in. If you've got any suggestions, let me know. On top of all that, I've been rewriting a book I penned 10 years ago. Yes, this is a tongue-in-cheek non-fiction book on how to be a lesbian, basically. And it was due to be released in 2008, before Kindle was even a thing. Imagine, there was a world without Kindle, without independent publishing, without all the platforms that I currently use. So I signed a contract and I had a publisher in place. And then in 2008, the world blew up and the banking system collapsed and lots of companies went bust, including my publisher. So the book never happened, and I've kind of just forgotten about it. But now I've got it out of the drawer, and I've dusted it down, and it did make me laugh still. I mean, some of it made me cringe, obviously, because I would hope I'm a better writer than I was 10 years ago when I knew nothing. However, quite a lot of it has stood up. I'm probably going to be using about 50% of it, and I'm rewriting the rest of it. So the jury's still out if I can make something of it. I hope to, because I've started talking about it now, but you'll be the first to know. So I've been trying to rewrite that, but I must say I've had a bit of resistance around that, because writing non-fiction is very different to writing fiction. I think I'm going to refocus on getting London Actually out and then really give it a go, like do nothing else but the non-fiction book, because I've been fiddle-arsing around with it, basically. Fiddle-arsing, you heard it here first. On top of all that as well, August saw me hot-footing it to Bristol for the first ever European Lesbian Literature Conference, which was brilliant, frankly. I had no idea what to expect, but it was so well organised, so professional. It was at the Marriott in Bristol. It was brilliantly organised, really nice food as well, brilliantly catered. Yeah, and everything was just terrific. So well done to all the team behind that, who were basically five really enthusiastic readers organised it. So incredible work by them. And it was 2 days of panels, workshop and discussions about lesfic. And it was just a terrific first conference, and it was great to meet readers and authors alike and spend also 2 days roaming around Bristol, because I used to live in Bath and I haven't been to Bristol for quite a while. So it was great to go back to Bristol and hang out there. And Bristol is a lovely town, so I'd suggest going there. So coming back, I've also been viewing the rest of my year and how it's been going, because we're in month nine, chapter nine of 2018, as I like to call it. And there are 3.5 months of the year left. So how is your year going? Did you make any goals at the start of the year? Because with 3.5 months to go, there's still quite a chunk of time to make them happen. So now is a good time to reassess all the goals that you had and see if you've met them. And if you haven't, plan to do so over the next few months. Replan. I've been doing that this week as well. So looking back on my 2018 goals that I set out in January, I've succeeded in quite a lot of them, which is great. I've launched 5 audiobooks, which is terrific. I've done my first ever co-write with Harper Bliss, which went really well. I've written 2 other books, The London of Us and then London Actually, which will be out in October. Pretty good. And I've done public speaking and networking. I'm doing a talk to the London Metropolitan Police in September. And I'm generally being kinder to myself. So that was one of my goals. So pretty good. The only one I failed on 2. One is getting back into my gym habit and growing guns of steel. But I've got 3.5 months left of the year. And I'm going to do it. I was out with a friend last night, actually, and we were talking about it. And she's training for a half marathon. And she inspired me and said that, she'd be happy to go running with me. So maybe having a running partner would be the bomb. So, yeah, I just need to get a new sports bra. And goodness me, where do you get a good sports bra? If anyone knows, please tweet me at Claire Lydon and let me know, because every sports bra I buy is rubbish. So if you know where to get a good sports bra, because I just simply can't go running with the one I've got. It's not very supportive, let's put it that way. So yes, I'm going to do that. And I'm also, one of my other goals was to read a book from a different genre every month. I've failed to do that, although I am reading a lot more non-fiction, which is great. But the problem is there's too much great lesfic out there to read and it takes up all my time. So that's not my fault. It's the fault of all the fantastic authors bringing out fantastic books and making lesfic such an exciting genre. Honestly, I don't think it's ever been more exciting than it is now. So brilliant. Well done, authors all. Right, that's enough of my wittering. Now let's get up to the interview with the fabulous Lise McTague. Enjoy. Joining me today is Lise McTague, an American author who writes sci-fi, fantasy, supernatural and steampunk. She's a genuine genre crosser. Her latest book, which came out in June, is Demon in the Machine. And she's previously written Five Moons Rising and the On Deception's Edge series. Lise lives in North Carolina with her wife and family. So welcome, Lise.
Thank you for having me.
It's very lovely of you to be here. And how are you? It's Sunday morning where you are. Have you had a good Sunday morning so far?
So far, went to the library, but only to drop off books. So, you know, it could have been better. But
oh. You've already but it's
going to be a relatively cool day today, so I'm looking forward to that.
It's a beautiful day in London. Sun is shining, and we're going to go to a music festival after this, so it's a good day for it.
Very nice.
Yeah. So describe to me where you're talking to us from today. What can you see and where you are?
Well, I'm in my office. I can see my cat, who would like to get out of the office. and he's doomed to disappointment, I'm afraid.
So he'll be joining us for the whole chat.
Possibly. Mm. Unless he starts making a ruckus, in which case I will probably excuse myself to let him out.
Yeah, okay.
We'll see how that goes.
Okay, what's your cat called?
His name is Wheatley. He is an orange tabby, and he adopted our family a number of years ago. He'd been a stray and then decided that our home looked like a good one.
Well, so you're sitting in your office. Is that where you do most of your writing?
It's complicated, but you have a question where I think I'll cover that in more detail. It's where I do most of my typing,
right?
Which is probably the most accurate way to put it.
Okay.
The great thing about it is that it's on the second floor and it looks out into a bunch of trees, and so I get to see bird activity from time to time.
Okay,
which is a nice break.
Yeah, that is nice. So tell me a little bit about your writing journey then and how you got started.
Well, I really got started about 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
when I started, you know, putting things down to paper. I'd written as a kid, mm-hmm. Silly stuff, not really worth looking at again. I tried once. It was very embarrassing. I put it away. But I started writing in 2013 because I'd had insomnia for 2 years.
Mm.
And I dealt with that by telling myself stories, because it was something that I could do to keep my brain occupied and not get too angry about the fact that I couldn't sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also something that I could let go when I started to finally get sleepy. So after 2 years of doing that, I realized that I had this story pretty well realized in my head. And at that point, I was like, well, I spent a lot of time on this. I might as well do something with it. And so that's when I started writing down the first words of what would become the On Deception's Edge series.
Right.
And that was fun because, you know, I'd been telling myself stories, right? I had no idea how that was going to translate into words on a page.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd originally conceived of that entire trilogy as one book. And I was about a third of the way into what would become Depths of Blue when I realized this is going to be very long. where can I break it up?
How did you get that first one published? You approached some publishers?
Yeah, I did a lot of reading of lesfic, mostly with an eye on, you know, who was writing the kinds of stories that I wanted to read and who was doing, you know, good editing, putting out a polished product. And Bella was the top of my list, and I submitted to them, and I had a list of, you know, 6 or 7 publishers that I planned to work my way down. And Bella said, we want to do that. And I said, great, now I don't have to write all these other people.
Yeah. So you were accepted right off the bat, so that must have been pretty thrilling.
It was very thrilling and incredible, you know, completely surprising. I'd read all these things, you know, telling you, be prepared for rejection. You won't get into the first place that you query to. And so, yeah, I was fully expecting to. Oh, and there's the cat. All right. I will be right back. Yeah. So, you know, I prepared for the worst and was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. And so since then you've published, how many sort of 5 books is it now?
5 books, yeah. Yes, and I'm in the middle of the second draft of my 6th, which mm-hmm. is due to Bella in December, so I have to get on that.
Yes. December will come around quicker than you think.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It always does.
So let's talk about your most recent book then, the one I read for this interview, which I really enjoyed, Demon in the Machine. And it's like nothing I've ever read before, because I am a self-confessed romance writer and reader. I love a good rom-com. But this one was a Victorian-era steampunk novels that had realms of romance, thriller, mystery and paranormal. And it was a fantastic romp of a book. And I really did enjoy it. So tell me how you came up with the idea for the novel, because it's very, very unique.
Thank you. Yeah, this one took me a while to get there. Generally, when I have an idea for a book, it's pretty fully formed and I can jump right in. But Demon in the Machine originally started out as I was going to do a Highwayman novel.
Mm-hmm.
And also somebody had pointed out that my books feature a lot of kidnapping. And so I decided that I wanted to maybe turn that on its head a bit. And so I wanted to kidnap the kidnapper, and I was going to do this Highwayman thing. And then I did some research into, you know, sort of the era of highway robbery and realized that it ended sort of a little before, but was definitely dead by the advent of the steam engine and railroads. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really interested in writing something that was went that far back. I had in mind something, you know, a little more sort of Victorian. And when I started doing my research, I realized that the highwayman, the highwaywoman character was not a good fit for that. And so I had, you know, that kernel of Isabella already there, because I knew that, you know, she was going to be a somewhat nefarious character. And then I had to figure out, okay, so how where would she actually fit then in the era that I did want to write in, which was, you know, sort of more Victorian. So that's how she became a cat birdwing debutante.
Yes, I love that. I love that about her. I love all the descriptions of Isabella going about her business.
Yes, Isabella is a very fun character. And I sort of amped up the fun because I wanted her foil to be a much more sort of uptight character, and that's where Briar came about. Though Briar is actually a character that I've been working on for a story that ended up going nowhere. But I really liked her character. I just felt in the story that I've been writing that she wasn't in the right place. It wasn't the right story for her.
Yeah.
So at some point I realized that, wait a minute, you know, you've got this perfect character sitting over here in the story that's I'm not going to do anything with. Why don't we just move her over and see how she works with Isabella? And it turned out she works really well with Isabella. So, you know, that's when I decided, okay, I've got my setting, I've got my characters. Mm-hmm. What do I want to do with them?
Yeah, let's make a book.
Right.
And when you brought Briar over from this other story that you were working on, was she a half demon then, or did you turn her into a half demon?
She was picked up from that story and plopped in pretty much unchanged. Right. The one I've been working on had been a contemporary paranormal.
Right.
Okay. And there was just something about her character that just didn't fit the setting. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, probably sort of the very proper and buttoned up aspect of things. Yeah. Just wasn't working with the setting and the character I was, the other character I was, you know, setting her up with / against. So I didn't have to do much to her. Just, you know, sort of drop her in fully formed and yeah, it turned out she just was meant to be in Victorian London.
Yeah, cool. And let's talk about Victorian London, because what struck me as well when I was reading this was the world building that you had to do. It was pretty immense, because we're not in modern times, we're in Victorian London, but also fantasy. And so you have to create and describe everything, and you do it beautifully. And I was fully immersed when I was reading it in all the smells, sights and sounds. So tell me about creating such huge worlds, because that is a whole nother level of intricacy, I imagine.
Yeah, I really love world building. I had to do, you know, everything pretty much from the whole cloth for On Deception's Edge, because that's space opera. And then when I wrote my paranormal, I decided that, you know, I don't want to do all this world building. Let's do something a little easier. And so I based that in modern day Chicago, which was very close to where I was living at the time. And I'd spent a fair amount of time down there. So that was easier. But, you know, there's always, you know, it's paranormal. I had to do a lot of world building around sort of the various creatures and that sort of thing. And then so I decided, okay, well, you know, we've done made up out of the whole cloth and we've done in your backyard. Let's do something in between. And this was actually probably my most challenging world building, because unlike On Deception's Edge, I couldn't just make it up out of the whole cloth. You know, there had to be enough there that was true to real life to resonate and to ground the story. But there was also a lot of stuff that I wanted to do that obviously wouldn't have been possible at that time. And so I had to come up with, you know, somewhat plausible ways that it could exist in that time. And that's actually how I went from, you know, sort of pure steampunk to adding that paranormal element in. Because while I love steampunk as a genre, one of the things I'm always aware of is steam can't do everything it does in steampunk. So that's where I brought the paranormal aspect in more fully, was by sort of juicing my steampunky gadgets with, in this case, demonic magic.
Yeah.
You know, just give it that extra oomph, the extra power, and make it more plausible by making it more magical, I guess.
Yeah.
Which, when I say it out loud, doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it did at the time.
Yeah, no, it was incredible to read, actually, especially for me, because I'd never read anything at all like this. So, and I'm always one of those people who said, well, it's not really my thing, but actually, everyone should go out and read this book, because it was really great. And even if you think it's not your thing, it could be. So let's talk about as well the language and the dress, because I thought you had those down to a T as well from that era. So what sort of research did you do for that?
I did a fair amount of research. A lot of the research that, you know, like the going on and like getting books from the library and looking things up online was actually more around the technology. I did a lot of research into nobility, and especially in that era, because I wanted to get that right. And, you know, as someone who grew up in Canada and now lives in the U.S., we don't have a whole lot of exposure to, you know, how all that works. And I remember, you know, sort of banging my head against, like, the different ways you address people, the different situations, and, you know, who's related to who and how does that change forms of address. And I think I got it pretty close to right, but anything that's wrong is totally my fault. But a lot of the language and the dress, I used to, you know, steal my mother's romance novels when I was in high school, and she read a lot of, you know, period romance novels. So
right. Yeah.
I think I absorbed a lot of that from there. Plus, the fun thing about writing Demon in the Machine is that it's a lot closer to my natural language when I'm writing than other things that I've published. So I didn't have to change up a whole lot about the phrasing and the language in subsequent drafts, unlike my previous novels where I, you know, the language just wasn't appropriate for the tone. And so I had to do a lot of editing to get it there. With Demon in the Machine, I could, you know, be kind of flowery and overly descriptive, and it worked. So I didn't have to take a huge amount of it back out again.
Okay, so it kind of suited your natural voice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. And talking of the dress, the sex scenes in the book were very different to any I've read as well, because they had a lot of clothing on. So it took a long time to unbutton all those corsets and buttons and layers. So I really did love that. So again, did that all come from like the stuff you read of your mums?
Yeah, a lot of it did. We watched a number, my wife and I made her sit down and watch a number of TV shows that were based in that era, so I could get more of a visual of the clothing and take some notes on that. So I did a little bit more research that way. Penny Dreadful, the series, I think it was on Netflix. It might still be on Netflix. It's a paranormal TV series that's set in Victorian London. It was perfect for my purposes. We watched a lot of that, and so that really helped me get a handle on the dress.
Right. Okay. Yeah. But that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Because I was talking the other day about sort of stealing from all different media, and I think that's a crucial part of writing. So yeah, it's great to do that. I always watch Grey's Anatomy for how they do romance, because I think it's a masterclass. So, and also characters and stuff. And also, as well as I said, there's sort of thriller, there's romance, but there's a lot of action in this, especially at the end when the tension's ramped up and the action goes for it. And the sequences you wrote were particularly gripping. So is that sort of something that you really like to do? And how many drafts of those do you do before you're happy with them?
Yeah, my favorite thing to write is action.
I think that comes for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, my wife has to put up with me complaining that all my characters want to do is talk and they won't do anything when we're in a particularly, you know, sort of feelings heavy portion of whatever manuscript I'm in.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, for me, the the feelings are sort of what we have to suffer through to get back to the action. I try not to have that come out in my writing, but there's, you know, there's certainly parts when I'm actually writing it where it's like, oh, for Christ's sake, just do something already. But I really like action. It's really easy for me to, you know, sort of visualize all that in my head. And I really like being able to get very, you know, getting very tactile with action scenes, and also to describe, you know, not only what the characters are doing, but what they're feeling. So I'm always trying to, you know, hit a good balance between doing and then what the characters are feeling and thinking, and sort of like their internal reactions to the physical action that's going on around them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how many drafts do you think, like, is action something that you just do and it's sort of almost there first straight away as soon as you write it, or do you have to keep going back and adding?
It depends on the novel. Occasionally, you know, so generally I write very linearly, and I, you know, do everything about my novel writing, including the editing, in a very linear fashion. So everything gets written out kind of in one go. Mm-hmm. Generally, you know, scenes get about as much, you know, tweaking as all of the others. Mm-hmm. But if I have something that's, you know, coming up as not being quite right with my beta readers, I will definitely give it further, you know, further reviewing. I also have a great editor, Medora McDougall, is fantastic about catching me on the whole continuity thing. There's a scene at the end of Human and the Machine where Isabella is trying to switch the polarity on this device, and she's like moving these, you know, these big hoses over from one device to another. And we went back and forth a number of times because I had apparently forgotten halfway through writing that scene how many hoses there were. And so we had to figure out, okay, how many were there? And because we cut back and forth between her and Isabella during that scene, it was a matter of, okay, me figuring out how many Isabella had moved when the sort of the camera was off of her, and then where we came back. And mm-hmm. Yeah, so that one required a fair amount of tweaking.
Right.
Anytime we put, you know, concrete numbers on things, I have to go back and double check. Yeah. Just because, you know, for me, it's all like, no, this just happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the case with a lot of writing, isn't it? I know when I put, you know, 2 weeks later or something, and then I go come back and go, how, what's the timeline on that? Then I just put a couple of weeks later, make it more vague.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I also loved
one of the things I always have to do my, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go.
I was going to say, one of the things I always have to do in my second draft is create the timeline where mm-hmm. I actually write out day by day what's happening, because when I'm writing it out the first time, it all just kind of flows.
Yeah.
And then in that second draft, I need to know, okay, you know, how much time actually happens when people refer back to it. It's accurate and not really squishy.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you on that. I've just done the third draft of the manuscript I'm working on. I've just written out the timeline just to check it's all right. So I've just nailed it down now. So, but it does take a little while to firm up. And mm-hmm. I was going to say about the adventure, the action sequences. I think that your pacing is really, really. It's one of the most strongly paced books I think I've read in a while. You know, it's like at the end of every chapter I wanted to know what was going to happen in the next one. So kudos on that one as well. I thought that was brilliantly done.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your last book, Five Moons Rising, which garnered some great reviews. So do you want to tell listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, I'm proud of Five Moons Rising. Five Moons Rising is a contemporary paranormal romance. It features my two main characters are Malice, who is a genetically engineered super soldier created by the U.S. government to track down supernatural creatures, or what they call supernormals. Mm-hmm. And Ruri is her love interest. And Ruri is... Well, Ruri is the werewolf that Malice kidnapped to help Malice's sister through the transformation after Cassidy, Malice's sister, is attacked by werewolves. So, yeah, it's a fairly dark book. Demon in the Machine I actually wrote somewhat in response to Five Moons Rising, just because Five Moons Rising is so dark. I wanted to do something a little sort of lighter, mm-hmm. And a little fluffier than Five Moons Rising had been. But a lot of people have really responded really well, I think, to the darkness in that particular book. It's done, you know, just really well for me in a way that well, I didn't expect, but I still feel very new to this whole publishing thing, so I never know what to expect, or maybe that's just what publishing is. You never know what to expect.
I think that's right. I think sometimes you write a book and you think, wow, this is going to do brilliantly, and then it's the one that you're not so sure about that might spring out and be the hit with readers. You just never know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a constantly changing thing. But yeah, well, it sounds very intriguing, so I might have to pick that one up as well. And you've also written the sci-fi series On Deception Edge. I can't say that, can I? Which has three books. So you've written sci-fi, supernatural, and steampunk. So are you going to settle on one genre, or are you going to keep jumping around?
Oh, no, I'll keep jumping around. I view spec fic as one genre, and everything else is just, you know, shades of it in between. And so it's funny when I hear people saying that I'm jumping between genres, because to me, I feel like I'm sticking in kind of the same thing. Mm-hmm. But my view of speculative fiction as a genre is very broad. So, I've got plans in the hopper for a number of books. There's at least one high fantasy in there. There's another space opera that I'm looking at. And, of course, I'm writing the sequel right now to Five Moons Rising. And so, you know, I'll be heading right back to contemporary paranormal pretty soon.
So is that the one you're writing at the moment that's got to be at Bella by December, the sequel?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes, I had a lot of people asking for a sequel. And I've been planning on doing one sort of down the road, but I had so many people saying, we want a sequel. But I said, well, I guess I'm running this one.
Yeah. The people have spoken. And do you find, when you say speculative fiction, what do you mean exactly by that?
So my view of speculative fiction is pretty much any fiction that has things that we don't find in real life.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, my definition is very broad. Mostly because it's like, well, it's all the stuff I like to read.
Yeah. Because I would imagine there would be some crossover between, as you say, like if we break out your books to supernatural, paranormal, sci-fi, steampunk, I'd imagine there'd be some crossover in reading there.
Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, great. So I know you work full time, so how do you manage your time and your writing process?
Well, I am privileged in that, so I just ended a job that was not particularly exciting for me, but it gave me a lot of time to do writing while things were processing on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
I had a very old, very slow computer, and I was processing files, and there just wasn't a whole lot I could do on the computer while it was doing that, because everything would get very slow and kludgy. And so I would write out my day's words on, you know, just on a legal pad, just do it longhand. And then when I get home in the afternoon, I would type those out. I do write with a word goal in mind, typically.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
And well, it depends. This particular book, so for Hunter's Descent, that I'm working on right now, was 1,450 words per day during the week, because that would allow me to get about 100,000 words in 3 months.
Right, yep.
And then, of course, the book ended up being 142,000 words. So it took me a little longer than I'd anticipated. but not by a huge margin. Previous books, it's a lot of the time it's dependent on sort of how much time I felt I could spend on it. When I was writing On Deception's Edge, my goal was 750 words a day, mm-hmm. but I was also in a job where I didn't have as much time where I could, you know, where I had downtime that I needed something to fill my time with.
Yeah.
And generally I work in the afternoons after I get home from work. I like to get to work early. I work from about 7 until 3:30. So that gives me time to get home and get some work done before I have to make dinner.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. That's really, I admire greatly people who go out to work full time and then come home and write every day, because I think that's an amazing feat to do. But I know a lot of people do it. So
I would love to be able to do this full time. But I think I'm going to have to, you know, either switch out of making it exclusively lesbian or figure out a way to write contemporary romance. And I haven't been able to wrap my head around doing either of those things yet. So.
Yeah. Yeah. If you have the breakout contemporary romance, you can put your feet up. I was listening to an interview with Bella Andre the other day. She's very inspiring and she writes contemporary romance and has sold 7 million books. So that's the... That's the way to go.
Yeah,
pretty amazing. So, what's your favorite thing about writing, and what's your least favorite thing, would you say?
Oh goodness, my favorite thing about writing is when you get that idea and things start percolating in your brain. It's such a fantastic time, because you know at that point, there are no limits, and you can do whatever, and you get to discover the story and the characters, and it's all very, very exciting. My least favorite thing about writing is, well, actually, the non-writing stuff that goes with it, the marketing and that sort of thing that you have to do when the book is coming out. I feel so awkward and awful doing that. And I just want to go back and just work on the new idea that's percolating in my brain. But you know, you have to let people know that you've gotten this thing and it's out.
You do.
So that they can check it out.
Yeah.
I know. It's so inconvenient that I have to, you know, be involved in telling people about it. But I just want to be working on the next thing.
Yeah. Well, you're doing just that right now. You're letting a lot of listeners know about your next book. So that's pretty cool.
Yes.
And on the days when you're finding it difficult to get going, do you have any tricks that you do to change up your mindset and get you in the mood?
A lot of the times it's just about forcing myself to go and write something. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, in that first draft, you have to acknowledge that there are parts of it that are not going to be very good. But it's going to be a lot easier to come back and sort of fix those on the second pass if there is something there than if there's nothing there at all. And also, you know, it's about, you know, sort of giving myself permission not to hit my word goal that day. I'm very sort of goal oriented. And so for me, I sometimes get some anxiety around knowing that it's unlikely that I will hit exactly what I want to. Mm-hmm. But if I remind myself, there are plenty of days where I hit more than my goal. And plus my daily goal is actually a breakdown of a weekly goal. So if I don't hit my full goal that day, I generally will have, you know, more days later in the week where I can still hit that weekly goal.
Yeah.
So, you know, reminding myself of that. And so I did go through a period recently where I had, I think it was 9 months where I didn't write anything. Oh. I had some, a fairly massive problem, mm-hmm. with writer's block.
Okay.
Which I hadn't thought would be a problem for me, because I always thought that writer's block was one of those things that happened when you didn't know what to write. And it wasn't that I didn't have ideas. I had lots of ideas. I had lots of stories, you know, inside me that I wanted to tell. My problem was is that I could not get myself into sort of the right frame of mind where I could concentrate on something at that level long enough to get it out. And of course, this was right after the 2016 election had happened in the U.S., and I was feeling a lot of stress around that, and I actually ended up going to talk to a therapist around about those issues, because that anxiety was not only, you know, keeping me from writing, but it was also affecting, you know, how I was at home around kids mm-hmm. and with my wife, and I was just very on edge a lot, and, you know, part of that was that, you know, made it so that I couldn't write, and part of that also made it so that I wasn't a very fun person to be around. And those were both things that I wanted to address. So talking to somebody about it, figuring out how to deal with what turns out to be a generalized anxiety disorder, and also being able to give myself a break has meant that I could actually come back and get a good chunk of writing done in a much shorter period of time, and feel like I could make some progress again.
Yeah. Oh, that's, I mean, I think a lot of writers do go through periods like that, but triggered by external events or not. But I think good advice is to be kind to yourself, and it's good that you came back and you're now back on track and churning out great books again. So that's great. And what's the best piece of writing advice you've ever been given, would you say?
It's sort of a codicil to the write what you know piece of advice, which on its own I think is actually horrible advice. Yeah. A lot of people, yeah. I mean, if we only wrote what we knew, we would just spend our days churning out memoirs, and how many of those can we write?
Yeah.
I attended a workshop at GCLS given by Karen Callmaker, and it was about, you know, research for writers. And her thing was is that, yes, write what you know, but expand what you know. So, you know, once you've done the research and once you've gotten to know your topic, well, now you're writing what you know again. And so, you know, getting sort of that idea through my head, and that, you know, I wasn't a bad writer for the fact that I was writing about things that didn't exist. It was just writing, you know, writing what you know, but in a different way. There's, you know, the research is there to back it up. And I also feel like part of, you know, a lot of people interpret write what you know very literally. Mm-hmm. Part of it can also be around sort of authenticity of emotion. You know, if you don't have that, your book just won't resonate. But if the emotions are authentic and your setting is realistic and plausible, I feel like you can get away with a lot.
Yeah. I really like that, actually. I really like that advice, because I do agree that write what you know is very limiting. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you just wrote what you knew, it would be, you'd run out of ideas probably quite soon. So I like that sort of research angle, and then you're still writing what you know. And if Karen Callmaker tells you to do something, you do it. That's what I think. So
absolutely.
I'm very jealous that you were in a discussion with her, so I think I could listen to her all day. And final question for you: if you could be the love child of any two writers, alive or dead, who would you choose and why?
That is a very fun question. It really made me think about this one. But what I've settled on are Nicola Griffith and Megan O'Brien. So Nicola Griffith writes, well, she writes amazingly. Both authors do. But what Nicola Griffith does really, really well is she's a fantastic world builder. Mm-hmm. And she taps sort of really well into that authenticity of emotion. Mm-hmm. And also she's excellent at sort of pulling themes through her work without hitting you over the head with them. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I aspire to. I really enjoy thematic writing, but I feel like I'm a little sort of 2x4 to the back of the head with it. and I mean, well, anyone who knows me knows that subtlety is not my forte. So if I could get some of that from her, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
And then Megan O'Brien, of course, is on the opposite end of the spectrum as far as writing goes. She writes mostly erotic romance. But boy, she really, she does so well with chemistry and that connection between characters. And I'm very jealous of her abilities in that area, and I can only aspire to write a sex scene as hot as she can manage.
Okay. Do you know what? Megan O'Brien has been on my to-read list for a very long time, and I still haven't done it. So which book should I start with? Is there one that you particularly like?
Oh, goodness. Well, I tell people that whichever book of hers I read last is my favorite. Because you're not as much into the paranormal more the spec fic. There are, I wouldn't start with Wild or The Three. I really liked Camp Rewind, which is a paranormal romance, and it has one of the hottest makeout scenes in it that I have ever read.
Well, there you go. That is a recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she makes it so hot, and it's not, you know, it's not the full, it's not the full act, but it is so good.
Yeah, well, quite often a good kissing scene can be incredible, I think. So, and like you say, but it takes a lot to do it well. So, it'd be interesting to read. So that's a great pairing, I think. So well done. And where can people find out more about you?
Oh, I'm in a bunch of places. I have a website, lisemactague.com. That's lisemactague.com. It's not updated as often as I would like, but I'm there, and you can get to a number of my other activities that way. I'm also on Facebook, just as Lise McTague, and I am on Twitter at lisemctague.com. You can also catch up with me. I do a podcast with Andy Marquette. It's called Les Geek Out, and we discuss pop culture through a lesbian feminist lens, and we are on the Lesbian Talk Show. That's our sort of overall channel, the one that Sheena also puts out.
Okay, great. So the Lesbian Talk Show. Well, thank you so much, Lise. This has been great, and I hope you have a fantastic rest of Sunday.
Oh, thank you so much for your time, and that music festival sounds fantastic.
That's the end of this Lesbian Book Club. So this is me, your host, Claire Lydon, signing off. If you'd like to dip into any of my books, the London Romance series, the All I Want series, Nothing to Lose, Twice in a Lifetime, or The Long Weekend, or indeed Once Upon a Princess, my co-write with Harper Bliss, you can find them all at all the major retailers, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple, Kobo, Bella Books, and all the other digital outlets around the globe. I also have 6 audiobooks out, the London Romance series exclusive to Audible, but the other 2, Nothing to Lose and Twice in a Lifetime, available on all sorts of audio platforms, so do give them a listen. Thanks very much to Denise at the Lesbian Lounge for hosting and producing this podcast. It's much appreciated. And if you'd like to try some of my work and you'd like a free lesbian romance, head on over to www.clairelydon.co.uk, put your email in the box at the top, and I'll send you one. If you want to follow me on social media, check me out at Claire Lydon on Twitter, at ClaireFic on Instagram, and Claire.Lydon on Facebook, although I'm most active on Twitter and Instagram. Thanks so much, and join me next month when I'll be interviewing hotshot debut author whose book hung around the charts for absolute eons this year, and that is Elle Spencer with her book Casting Lacey. See you next month.